But to D'Artagnan, all aspects indicated beauteous forms. All images were wreathed in smiles. All darkness was transparent light. The appointed hour was on the eve of striking. In fact, at the end of a few minutes, the belfry of Saint-Cloud slowly emitted 10 strokes from its broad, sonorous jaws. There was something melancholy in that voice of bronze, which thus breathed its lamentations in the night. But each of those sounds, which told the hour he sighed for, vibrated harmoniously in the heart of the young man. His eyes were fixed on the pavilion, which stood at the corner of the wall, and of which all the windows were closed with shutters, except one upon the first floor. From this window there shone a soft light, which silvered over the trembling foliage of 2 or 3 linden trees, which formed a group outside the park. Doubtless, behind that little window, which was so kindly lighted up, the pretty Madame Bonancieux awaited him. A lingering sentiment of diffidence restrained her, but now that the hour had struck, the window would be opened, and D'Artagnan would at last receive from the hands of love the meed of his devotion. Flattered by this sweet belief, D'Artagnan waited a half hour, without any impatience, keeping his eyes fixed upon that charming little abode, and distinguishing through the upper part of the window a part of those gilded cornices of the ceiling which gave evidence of the elegance of the remainder of the apartment. The belfry of Saint-Cloud proclaimed 10:30. But this time, without his knowing why, a shudder ran through the veins of D'Artagnan. Perhaps, also, the cold began to affect him, and he mistook for a moral impression what was in reality a sensation altogether physical. Then the idea occurred to him that he had mistaken the hour of appointment, and that it must have been at 11 instead of 10. He approached the window, placed himself under the ray of light, drew the letter from his pocket, and read it again. He was not mistaken. The appointment was really for 10 o'clock. He resumed his post, becoming uneasy at the silence and solitude. It struck 11. D'Artagnan began to fear that something had really happened to Madame Bonancieux. He clapped his hands 3 times, the usual signal of lovers, but nothing, not even echo, returned an answer. And then he thought, with some displeasure, that the young woman had perhaps fallen asleep whilst waiting for him. He approached the wall and attempted to climb it. But the wall was newly rough-cast, and he broke his nails to no purpose. At this moment he thought of the trees, of which the leaves were still silvered over by the light, and perceiving that one drooped over the road, he fancied that from amidst its branches he might be able to see into the pavilion. The tree was easy to climb. Besides, D'Artagnan was scarcely 20 years of age, and therefore well remembered his schoolboy habits. In an instant he was in the midst of its branches, and through the transparent windows his eyes plunged into the interior of the pavilion. Strange it was, and it made him shudder from the soles of his feet to the hair of his head, to find that that gentle flame, that quiet lamp, threw light upon a scene of frightful disarray. One of the panes of the window was demolished, the door of the room had been broken open, and hung, half broken, on its hinges. A table, which must have been covered with an elegant supper, lay upon the ground, and glasses in fragments and crushed fruits were thickly spread upon the floor. Everything in the room indicated a violent and desperate struggle, and D'Artagnan believed that he could even detect, amidst this strange medley, some strips of clothes and some stains of blood congealed on the tablecloth and curtains. With his heart beating horribly, he hastily descended to the ground to examine if he could not find some further traces of violence. The small and gentle light still shone amidst the calmness of the night. D'Artagnan then perceived, what had escaped him at first when nothing prompted him to so close a scrutiny, that the ground was broken in one place and dug up in another, and was marked by confused impressions of the footsteps of both men and horses. The wheels of a carriage, which seemed to have come from Paris, had, moreover, left upon the soft soil a deep rut, which proceeded no further than the pavilion, and then returned again towards Paris. And, last of all, in pursuing his researches, he found near the wall a woman's torn glove. But this glove, wherever it had not come in contact with the mud, was irreproachably fresh. It was one of those perfumed gloves which the lover likes to pull from a pretty hand. As D'Artagnan pursued these investigations, at every fresh discovery a more abundant and more icy moisture stood upon his brow. His heart was wrung with fearful anguish, and his respiration almost failed. "And yet," said he to encourage himself, "perhaps this pavilion had nothing to do with Madame Bonancieux. Her appointment was before the pavilion, not within it. She has possibly been detained in Paris by her duties, or probably by her husband's jealousy." But all these reflections were beaten down, destroyed, driven to flight by that internal sentiment of grief which on some occasions takes exclusive possession of our entire being and announces in an unmistakable language that some great suffering hovers over our heads. And then D'Artagnan became almost frantic. He ran upon the highway, hastened along the road he had come by, and advanced as far as the ferryboat and questioned the ferryman. About 7 o'clock in the evening, the ferryman had ferried over a woman, enveloped in a dark cloak, who seemed to be exceedingly anxious to escape recognition. But precisely on account of her precautions, he had been the more observant, and had discovered that she was young and pretty. There were then, as now, crowds of young and pretty women who came to Saint-Cloud, and who had reasons for desiring to remain unseen. Yet D'Artagnan doubted not for an instant that it was Madame Bonancieux whom the ferryman had brought across. D'Artagnan took advantage of the lamp in the ferryman's cottage to read the note of Madame Bonancieux once more, and to assure himself that he had made no mistake, that the appointment was really at Saint-Cloud and not elsewhere, and before the pavilion of Monsieur d'Estrées, and not in another street. Everything concurred to prove to D'Artagnan that his presentiments were not groundless, and that some great misfortune had actually occurred. He ran back towards the castle, fancying that, during his absence, something new might have taken place at the pavilion, and that some fresh instructions might be awaiting him there. The lane was still deserted, and the same calm, soft light streamed from the window. D'Artagnan then remembered that dark and wretched cottage, which doubtless had seen and might perhaps also speak. The gate of the enclosure was shut, but he jumped over the hedge and, in spite of the barking of a chained dog, approached the cottage. At his first summons, no one answered. A death-like silence prevailed here, as well as in the pavilion, yet as this cottage was his last resource, he persisted. Now he fancied he heard a slight noise within, a timid noise which seemed itself to be afraid of being heard. Then D'Artagnan ceased to knock, and made entreaties in such a piteous accent of fear mingled with flattery, that his voice would have reassured the most timorous. At length an old worm-eaten shutter was opened, or rather half-opened, and instantly shut again, as soon as the light of a miserable lamp which was burning in a corner had disclosed the belt, the hilt of the sword, and the pistols of D'Artagnan. And yet, quick as had been the movement, he had been able to see the head of an old man. "In the name of heaven," said he, "listen to me. I expected someone who is not come. I am dying from anxiety. Has any misfortune happened in your neighbourhood? Speak!" The window was again slowly opened, and the same countenance reappeared, only it was paler than before. D'Artagnan told his story simply, merely withholding names. He stated that he had an appointment with a young woman before this pavilion, and that, not seeing her come, he had climbed the linden tree, and had, by the light of the lamp, perceived the disorder of the room. The old man listened attentively, with many signs of assent, and when D'Artagnan had ended, shook his head in a manner which was not encouraging. "What do you mean?" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "In the name of heaven, explain yourself!"
"Oh, sir," said he, "do not ask me anything. For if I should tell you what I have seen, most assuredly no good will befall me."
"You have seen something, then?" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "In that case, in heaven's name," continued he, throwing him a pistol, "tell me what you have seen, and on the honor of a gentleman, not one of your words shall pass my lips." The old man read so much honesty and grief in D'Artagnan's countenance that he made him a sign to listen, and said in a low voice,
"It was about 9 o'clock that I heard some noise in the street, and wishing to know what it was, I was going to my gate when I saw some people trying to get in. As I am poor and have no fear of being robbed, I went to open it and saw 3 men a few paces from me. In the shade was a carriage, with horses harnessed to it, and also some led horses. These led horses evidently belonged to the three men who were dressed for riding. "Ah, my good sirs," I cried, "what do you want?" "You ought to have a ladder," said one, who appeared to be the leader of the party. "Yes, sir, that with which I gather my fruit. Give it to us, and go back into your house, and here is a crown for the trouble we give you. But remember, if you say one word about what you see or hear, for however we may threaten you, I am sure you will both hear and see all that we do, you are a lost man." At these words he threw me a crown, which I picked up, and he took my ladder. In fact, having fastened the gate in the hedge after them, I pretended to enter my house. But I went out again by the back door, and gliding in the shade, I came to those alder bushes, from the shelter of which I could see everything without being seen myself. The three men had brought up the carriage without any noise. They pulled out of it a fat, short, grey little man, shabbily dressed in a sad-coloured doublet, who carefully mounted the ladder, looked sulkily into the window, came down with a wolf's steps, and muttered in a low voice, "It is she." He who had spoken to me immediately went to the door of the pavilion, which he opened with a key which he had about him, and then shut the door after him and disappeared. The other two men mounted the ladder simultaneously. The little old man remained at the carriage door. The coachman took care of his horses, and a lackey of the led ones. Suddenly great outcries resounded from the pavilion, and a woman ran to the window and opened it as if to throw herself out. But as soon as she saw the two men, she threw herself back, and the two men rushed into the chamber after her. Then I saw nothing more, but I heard the noise of breaking furniture. The woman screamed and cried for help, but her cries were soon stifled. The three men returned to the window, carrying the woman in their arms, and two of them came down the ladder and bore her to the carriage, into which the little old man entered with her. He who had remained in the pavilion shut the window, came out at the door directly after, and satisfied himself that the woman was in the carriage. His two companions were already on their horses waiting for him. He sprang into his saddle, and the groom took his place beside the coachman. The carriage, escorted by the three horsemen, departed at a gallop, and all was over. From that moment until your arrival, I have neither seen nor heard anything.
D'Artagnan, overwhelmed by these terrible tidings, remained motionless and speechless, whilst the demons of jealousy and anger raged in his heart.
"But, my gentleman," said the old man, on whom this mute despair had more effect than cries and tears would have produced, "do not despond. They have not killed her. That is the great thing."
"Do you know at all," said D'Artagnan, "who is the man who conducted this infernal expedition?"
"I do not know him."
"But as he spoke to you, you could see him."
"Ah, it is his appearance that you want to know."
"Yes."
"A tall, lean, brown man, with black moustaches, a dark eye, and the look of a gentleman."
"That's it," cried D'Artagnan. "Him again. The same man. Always the same. It is my evil genius, apparently. And the other?"
"Which?"
"The little one."
"Oh, he was not a gentleman, I answer for it. Besides, he did not carry a sword, and the others treated him with no sort of respect."
"Some servant," muttered D'Artagnan. "Ah, poor woman, poor woman! What have they done with her?"
"You promised me to be secret," said the old man,
"and I renew my promise. Be satisfied. I am a gentleman. A gentleman has only his word, and I have given you mine." D'Artagnan returned towards the ferry, almost heartbroken. Sometimes he could not believe that it was Madame Bonancieux, and hoped to find her the next day at the Louvre. Sometimes he fancied that she had an intrigue with another, and had been discovered and carried off by some third party who was jealous of him. He doubted, sorrowed, and despaired. "Oh," cried he, "if I had but my friends here, I should at any rate have some hopes of finding her, but who knows what has become of them also?" It was then nearly midnight, and he must at once find Planchet. D'Artagnan searched successively every wine shop where he perceived a little light, but nowhere could he find his servant. At length, after examining half a dozen, he began to reflect that the search was rather fortuitous. He had himself said 6 o'clock in the morning. Therefore, wherever Planchet was, he was fully justified. Besides, it occurred to the young man that, by remaining in the neighborhood of the place where this event had happened, he might gather some information. At the 6th wine shop, as we have said, he therefore remained, and asking for a bottle of their best wine, placed himself in the darkest corner, and determined there to await the return of day. But this time, too, his hope was disappointed, and although he opened his ears to every sound, he heard nothing, amidst the oaths and gestures and abuse which were exchanged by the workmen, lackeys, and cab-drivers, who composed the honorable society of which he was a part, that could put him at all upon the track of the poor, ill-used woman. He was obliged, therefore, after having emptied his bottle, and in order that he might avoid remark, to occupy himself in seeking for the easiest posture in which to sleep as best he could. It must be remembered that D'Artagnan was not 20 years old, and at that age sleep has undeniable rights, which must be submitted to, even by the most desolate hearts. About 6 o'clock in the morning D'Artagnan awoke, with that feeling of discomfort which generally comes with the break of day after an uneasy night. His toilet did not occupy him long, and having searched himself to see that no one had taken advantage of his sleep to rob him, and found his diamond on his finger, his purse in his pocket, and his pistols in his belt, he paid for his wine, and sallied forth to try whether he should be more fortunate in seeking for his servant in the morning than at night. And the first thing that he perceived, through the damp, grey fog, was honest Planchet, who, with the 2 horses, was waiting for him at the door of a miserable little wine-shop, before which D'Artagnan had passed without even suspecting its existence. 25. Porthos. Instead of returning directly home, D'Artagnan dismounted at Monsieur de Tréville's door, and rapidly ascended the staircase. He was determined to tell him, this time, all that had occurred. Doubtless the captain would give him good advice in this affair, and, as Monsieur de Tréville saw the Queen almost daily, he might draw some information from Her Majesty concerning the poor woman who was unquestionably being punished for her devotion to her mistress. Monsieur de Tréville listened to the young man's recital with a gravity which proved that he saw something more in this adventure than an amour, and, when D'Artagnan had finished, "Hm," said he, "this savours of his eminence a mile off." "But what am I to do?" said D'Artagnan. "Nothing, absolutely nothing just now, but leave Paris, as I have told you, as soon as possible. I will see the Queen and tell her the details of the disappearance of this poor woman, of which she is doubtless ignorant, and these details will guide her on her side. And on your return, I may possibly have some good news to give you. Trust to me." D'Artagnan knew that, although a Gascon, Monsieur de Tréville was not accustomed to make promises, and that, when by chance he did make one, he always performed it to the full and more. He therefore took his leave, full of gratitude for the past and the future, and the worthy captain, who, on his side, felt a lively interest for this brave and resolute young man, affectionately pressed his hand as he wished him a good journey. Determined instantaneously to put Monsieur de Tréville's advice into execution, D'Artagnan hastened towards the Rue des Fossoyeurs to look to the packing of his portmanteau. On approaching number 11, he perceived Monsieur Bonancieux, in mourning costume, standing at his door. Everything that the prudent Planchet had said the evening before about the sinister character of his landlord now recurred to his mind, and he looked at him more attentively than he had ever done before. In fact, besides that yellow, sickly paleness, which indicates the infiltration of the bile into the blood, and which might be only accidental, D'Artagnan remarked something gruffly perfidious in the wrinkles of his face. A rascal does not laugh in the same manner as an honest man. A hypocrite does not weep with the same kind of tears as a sincere man. All imposture is a mask, and however well the mask may be made, it may always, with a little attention, be distinguished from the true face. Now it seemed to D'Artagnan that Monsieur Bonacieux wore a mask, and that this mask was a most disagreeable one. He was going, therefore, from his repugnance to the man, to pass by him without speaking, when Monsieur Bonacieux, as on the previous day, addressed him.
"Well, young man," said he, "it seems that we are rather late of nights. 7 o'clock in the morning! Plague! It appears that you reverse customs and return home when others emerge."
"No one could throw that in your teeth, Monsieur Bonacieux," said the young man. "You are the model of regularity. It is true that when one has a young and pretty wife, one need not run after happiness. Happiness comes home to seek us, does it not, Monsieur Bonacieux?"
Bonacieux became pale as death, and grinned a horrible smile.
"Ah, you are a pleasant fellow. But where the plague have you been running this night, my young master? It appears as if the by-lanes were rather dirty."
D'Artagnan lowered his eyes to his own boots, which were covered with mud. But in doing this, he happened to look at the shoes and hose of the mercer. One would have said that they had been dipped in the same slough, for both were stained with spots of exactly the same appearance. A sudden idea came across D'Artagnan's mind. That little fat, grey, short man, like a lackey, clothed in a sad-coloured suit, and treated with no sort of respect by the swordsman of the escort, was Bonacieux himself. The husband had assisted in the abduction of his wife. A strong desire seized D'Artagnan to fly at the mercer's throat and strangle him, but he was a prudent youth, as we have said, and he restrained himself. Nevertheless, his change of countenance was so visible that Bonacieux was frightened, and endeavoured to retreat a step or two. But he was exactly before the half of the door that was closed, and the material obstacle which he thus encountered compelled him to keep the same place.
"Ah," said D'Artagnan, "you who joke in this manner, my brave fellow, it appears to me that if my boots need a rub of the sponge, your shoes also want a brush. And have you been rambling too, Master Bonacieux? By my faith, it would be quite unpardonable in a man of your age, and who, moreover, has got a wife as pretty as yours is." "Oh, mon Dieu, no," said Bonacieux. "But yesterday I went to Saint-Maude to gain some information concerning a servant whom I cannot do without. And as the roads were dirty, I have collected all this mud, which I have not yet had time to get rid of."
The place which Bonacieux had mentioned as the end of his journey was a new proof in confirmation of the suspicions that D'Artagnan had formed. Bonacieux had said Saint-Maude, because Saint-Maude was in an exactly opposite direction to Saint-Cloud. This probability was the first consolation he had found. If Bonacieux knew where his wife was, it would always be possible, by using extreme measures, to force the mercer to unclose his teeth and let out his secret. The great thing was to change this probability into certainty.
"Pardon me, my dear Monsieur Bonacieux," said D'Artagnan, "if I treat you without ceremony, but nothing makes me so thirsty as want of sleep. Hence I have a furious thirst. Allow me to beg a glass of water of you. You know you cannot refuse such a thing to a neighbor."
And without waiting for the permission of his landlord, D'Artagnan entered the house and cast a hasty glance at the bed. The bed was undisturbed. Bonacieux had not slept in it. He had, therefore, only returned an hour or two before, having accompanied his wife to the place where they had conducted her, or, at any rate, for the first stage.
"Thank you, Monsieur Bonacieux," said D'Artagnan, emptying the glass.
That is all I wanted of you. Now I will go home. I'm going to make Planchet brush my boots, and when he has finished them, I will send him, if you like, to brush your shoes. He left the mercer quite stupefied by this singular adieu, and wondering whether he had not run his own neck into a noose. At the top of the stairs he found Planchet, frightened out of his wits.
"Ah, sir!" cried the lackey, as soon as he saw his master. "Here indeed is something new! And how long you seemed to me in returning!"
"What is the matter now?" demanded D'Artagnan.
"Ah, I will give you leave to guess 100, nay, 1,000 times, before you find out the visitor I have received on your behalf during your absence."
"When was that?"
"About 30 minutes ago, whilst you were with Monsieur de Treville."
"And who has been here? Come, speak."
"Monsieur de Cavois."
"Monsieur de Cavois?"
"Yes, no other."
"The captain of His Eminence's guards?"
"Yes, himself."
"He came to arrest me?"
"I suspected so, sir, in spite of his wheedling way."
"He had a wheedling way, do you say?"
"That is to say, he was all honey, sir."
"Really?"
"He said he came from His Eminence, who had the greatest goodwill towards you, to beg you to follow him to the Palais Royal."
"And you answered him?"
"That the thing was impossible, seeing that you were from home, as he might perceive."
"And what did he say then?"
"That you must not fail to go there some time during the day." "And then he added, in a whisper, 'Tell your master that His Eminence is perfectly well disposed towards him, and that his fortune probably depends upon this interview.'"
"The snare is unskillful enough for the cardinal," said the young man, smiling.
"And as I discovered the snare, I told him that you would be quite in despair on your return." "Where is he gone?" demanded Monsieur de Cavois. "To Troyes, in Champagne," answered I. "And when did he go?" says he. "Yesterday evening."
"Planchet, my friend," interrupted D'Artagnan, "you are truly a valuable man."
"You understand, sir, I thought that there would be time enough, if you wished to see Monsieur de Cavois, to give me the lie by saying that you had not gone. It would then be me who had told the lie. And, as I am not a gentleman, I may tell lies, you know."
"Be easy, Planchet. You shall preserve your reputation as a man of truth. In 1/4 hour we will be off."
"It was just the advice I was going to offer you, sir. And where are we going now, if it is not being too curious?"
"Egad, exactly the opposite way to that which you said I was gone. Besides, are you not in as much anxiety to know what has become of Grimaud, Mousqueton, and Bazin, as I to hear of Athos, Porthos, and Aramis?"
"Yes, indeed, sir," said Planchet,
"and I will set off as soon as you please. The air of the country, I believe, will suit us both better than the air of Paris just now. Therefore, prepare the baggage, Planchet, and let us be off. I will march off first, with my hands in my pockets, that there may be no suspicion. You will join me at the Hôtel de Garde. Apropos, Planchet, I believe that you are right regarding our landlord, and that he is decidedly a most horrible rascal."
"Ah, believe me, sir, when I tell you anything in future, I am a physiognomist."
D'Artagnan descended first, as was agreed, and that he might have nothing to reproach himself with, he went again to the lodgings of his three friends, but no intelligence of them had been received. Only a perfumed letter, most elegantly addressed, had arrived for Aramis. D'Artagnan took charge of it. 10 minutes afterwards, Planchet rejoined him at the stables. D'Artagnan, that no time might be lost, had already saddled his own horse. "That will do," said he to Planchet, when he had fastened on his valise. "Now, saddle the other three, and let us be off."
"Do you believe we shall travel faster with 2 horses apiece?" asked Planchet, with his sharp look.
"No, Mr. Jester," replied D'Artagnan, "but with our 4 horses we may bring our 3 friends back. That is, if we can find them."
"Which would be a great chance," replied Planchet. "But we must not distrust the mercy of God."
"Amen," said D'Artagnan, bestriding his horse. They left the Hôtel des Gardes by the opposite ends of the street, as the one was to quit Paris by the barrier of La Villette, the other by the barrier of Montmartre, to rejoin each other at Saint-Denis. a strategic manoeuvre which, being punctually executed, was crowned with the most fortunate results. Thus D'Artagnan and Planchet entered Pierrefitte together. Planchet, it must be confessed, was more courageous by day than by night. But yet his natural prudence did not forsake him for an instant. He had forgotten none of the incidents of the former journey, and took every one for an enemy whom he met upon the road. On this account he always had his hat off, for which he was severely rebuked by D'Artagnan, who feared that this excess of politeness might cause Planchet to be taken for the valet of a man of little consequence. Nevertheless, whether the passengers were really softened by Planchet's extreme urbanity, or whether no enemies were stationed on the young man's path, our two travellers arrived, without any accident, at Chantilly, and dismounted at the tavern of the Great St. Martin, the same at which they had stopped upon their last journey. The landlord, seeing a young man followed by a servant and two led horses, advanced respectfully to his door. Now, as he had already travelled 11 leagues, D'Artagnan judged that he had better stop here, whether Porthos were at the hotel or not. But it might not be prudent at first to make any inquiries about the musketeer. The result of these reflections was that D'Artagnan, without asking any information from anybody, dismounted, recommended the horses to his servant's care, and, entering a small room reserved for those who wished to be alone, called for a bottle of the best wine, and as good a breakfast as the landlord could supply, a call which corroborated the high estimate that the innkeeper had already formed of his guest at first sight. D'Artagnan was served with a celerity which was quite miraculous. The regiment of guards was composed of the first gentlemen in the realm, and D'Artagnan, travelling with a servant and 4 splendid horses, could not fail of creating a sensation, in spite of the simplicity of his uniform. The host wished to wait on him himself, seeing which D'Artagnan made him bring 2 glasses, and began the following conversation. "By my faith, mine host," said D'Artagnan, filling 2 glasses, "I have asked for the best wine, and if you have deceived me, your sin will bring its own punishment, since, as I hate to drink alone, you're going to drink with me. Take this glass, then, and let us drink. To what shall we drink, that we may wound no one's feelings? Let us drink to the prosperity of your establishment."
"Your lordship does me great honour, and I sincerely thank you for your good wishes."
"But don't deceive yourself," said D'Artagnan. "There is more selfishness in my toast than you think for. It is only in prosperous houses that one gets well treated. In struggling inns everything runs to disorder, and the traveller is a victim to the landlord's embarrassment. Therefore, as I travel a great deal, and particularly on this road, I should like to see all the innkeepers making a fortune."
"In fact," said the landlord, "it appears to me that this is not the first time I have seen you, sir."
"Ah, I have passed through Chantilly perhaps 10 times, and have stopped at least 3 or 4 times at your house. Yes, I was here about 10 or 12 days ago, conducting 3 of my friends, musketeers. And one of them, by the by, quarrelled with a stranger here, a man who sought a quarrel with him."
"Ah, yes, true," said mine host. "I recollect it perfectly. Is it not of Monsieur Porthos that your lordship speaks?"
"That is the very name of my travelling companion. Mon Dieu, my dear landlord! Tell me, has any misfortune befallen him?"
"But your lordship must have remarked for yourself that he was not able to continue his journey."
"In fact, he promised to overtake us, but we saw no more of him."
"He has done us the honour to remain here."
"What? He has done you the honour to remain here?"
"Yes, sir, in this hotel. And we are somewhat uneasy over it."
"Why?"
"On account of certain expenses that he has incurred."
"Well, but the expenses he has incurred he will pay."
"Ah, sir, your words are a positive balm to my heart. We have been at considerable expense on his account, and only this morning the surgeon declared that if Monsieur Porthos did not pay him, he should proceed against me, as it was I who sent for him."
But is Porthos wounded, then?
I cannot tell you, sir.
What? You cannot tell me? You ought at any rate to know better than anybody else.
Yes, but in our trade we do not tell all we know, sir, particularly when we have been warned that our ears shall answer for our tongue.
Well, can I see Porthos?
Certainly, sir. Go to the first landing place on the staircase and knock at number 1. Only advise him that it is you.
What? Advise him that it is me?
Yes, some accident might happen else.
And what accident could happen to me?
Monsieur Porthos might mistake you for somebody belonging to the house, and might, in a fit of passion, either run you through with his sword or blow out your brains.
Why, what have you been doing to him, then?
Oh, we asked him for money.
Ah, I comprehend now. That is a kind of demand that Porthos always receives badly when he is not in cash. But I know that he ought to have plenty.
So we thought also, sir. And as the house is very regular, and our accounts are made up every week, on the 8th day we presented our little bill. But we seem to have hit upon an unlucky time, for at the first word we dropped upon the subject, he sent us all to the very devil. It is true he had been playing cards the evening before.
What? Playing the evening before? And with whom?
Oh, good Lord, who can tell that? With some nobleman who was travelling this way, and to whom he sent to propose a game at Loscanay.
Just so. And the unlucky dog lost his all.
Even to his horse, sir. For when the stranger was about to leave, we perceived that his servant was saddling Monsieur Porthos's horse, and we remarked it to him. But he told us that we had better mind our own business, and that the horse was his own. So we went immediately to let Monsieur Porthos know what was going on. But he only answered that we were scoundrels for doubting the word of a gentleman, and that, as this one had said that the horse belonged to him, it necessarily must be true.
I recognize him there exactly, muttered D'Artagnan.
Then, continued the innkeeper, I sent a message to him that, as we did not seem likely to come to any understanding with one another about payment, I hoped that he would at least have the kindness to transfer the favour of his custom to my brother landlord at the Golden Eagle. But Monsieur Porthos replied that as my hotel was the best, he desired to remain here. This answer was too complimentary for me to insist upon his leaving. I contented myself with begging him to resign his apartment, which is the most beautiful in the house, and to be satisfied with a pretty little room upon the 3rd floor. But to this Monsieur Porthos replied that he was every moment expecting his mistress, who was one of the highest ladies at court, and that I ought to understand that the chamber which he did me the honour to occupy in my house was scarcely good enough yet for such a visitor. Nevertheless, fully recognising the truth of what he said, I felt it my duty to insist. But without condescending to enter into any discussion with me, he put a pistol on his night-table, and declared that at the first word which might be said to him about any moving whatsoever, either out of the house or in it, he would blow out the brains of the person who had been imprudent enough to interfere in what did not concern him. So, since that time, sir, nobody has once entered his room but his own servant.
Oh, Mousqueton is here, is he?
Yes, sir. 5 days after his departure, he came back in a very ill humour.
This is the end of disc number 8. Please insert disc number 9. This is disc number 9.
Oh, Mousqueton is here, is he?
Yes, sir. 5 days after his departure, he came back in a very ill humor. It seems that he also had met with some unpleasantry on his way, but he is unfortunately rather nimbler than his master, so that he turns everything topsy-turvy and, under the pretext that we might refuse him what he asks for, takes anything he wants without asking at all.
The fact is, replied D'Artagnan, that I have always remarked in Mousqueton a very superior intelligence and zeal.
Possibly so, sir, but if I should only find myself 4 times in a year in contact with a similar intelligence and zeal, I should be bankrupt.
No, Porthos will pay you.
Exclaimed the innkeeper in a tone of doubt.
He is the favorite of a lady of rank, who will not allow him to remain in trouble on account of a trifle such as he owes you.
If I only dared to say what I think about that.
What do you think?
I might say more, what I know.
What you know?
Or even what I am quite sure of.
And what are you sure of? Come, say!
I should say that I know about this lady of rank.
You?
Yes, me.
And how came you to know about her?
Oh, sir, if I thought I could depend on your discretion...
Speak, and on the word of a gentleman you shall have no occasion to regret your confidence.
Well, sir, you can understand that uneasiness makes one do many things.
What have you done?
Oh, nothing but what a creditor has a right to do.
Well?
Monsieur Porthos had handed us a note for this duchess, giving us orders to put it in the post. It was before his own servant came, and as he could not leave his room, he was obliged to employ us in his commissions.
What next?
Instead of putting this letter in the post, which is uncertain, we took advantage of the occasion of one of our waiters going to Paris and instructed him to deliver the letter to this duchess herself. That was fulfilling the intentions of Monsieur Porthos, who had particularly enjoined us to be careful of the letter, was it not?
Nearly so.
Well, sir, do you know what this lady of rank is?
No, I've heard Porthos speak of her, that is all.
Do you know what this pretended duchess is?
I tell you again, I don't know her.
She is an attorney's wife, sir. An elderly woman called Madame Coquenard, who is at least 50 years of age, and yet takes it upon herself to be jealous. It seemed very strange to me, a princess living in the Rue aux Ours.
How do you know this?
Because she put herself in a great passion on receiving the letter, saying that Monsieur Porthos was a fickle man, and that it was on account of some woman that he had received this sword wound.
Then he has received a sword wound? Replied D'Artagnan.
Ah, mon Dieu, what have I said?
Cried the innkeeper.
You said that Monsieur Porthos had received a wound from a sword.
Yes, but he strongly enjoined me to say nothing about it.
And why?
Plague, sir, because he boasted that he would perforate the stranger with whom you left him in a dispute, whilst on the contrary this stranger stretched him on the ground in spite of his rodomontades. Now, as Monsieur Porthos is a very vainglorious man, except toward his duchess, whom he thought to soften by an account of his misadventure, he is not disposed to admit to anybody that he is suffering from a wound.
It is a sword wound, then, that keeps him in his bed.
And a masterly one, I assure you. Your friend's soul must be absolutely pinned to his body.
Were you there, then?
I followed them, sir, from curiosity, so that I saw the combat, myself invisible.
And how did it happen?
Oh, the thing did not take long, I assure you. They placed themselves on guard,
The stranger made a feint and lunged, and that so rapidly that when Monsieur Porthos parried, he had already 3 inches of steel in his chest. He fell back. The stranger put his sword to his throat, and Monsieur Porthos, seeing himself at the mercy of his adversary, confessed himself vanquished. The stranger then asked his name, and hearing that he was Monsieur Porthos and not Monsieur D'Artagnan, offered him his arm and led him back to the hotel, mounted on horseback, and disappeared.
Then it was Monsieur D'Artagnan that the stranger wanted.
It appears so.
And do you know what has become of him?
No. I had never seen him before that moment, and we have not seen him since.
Very well. I know all I want. And you say that Monsieur Porthos's chamber is on the first floor, number one?
Yes, sir, the handsomest in the house. A chamber which I might have let 10 or 12 times.
Ah, cheer up, said D'Artagnan, laughing. Porthos will pay you with the cash of the Duchess Coquenard.
Oh, sir, attorney's wife or duchess would be no matter to me if she would only unloosen her purse strings. But she has positively said that she is tired out by the inconstancies and exigencies of Monsieur Porthos, and that she will not send him even a sou.
And did you communicate this reply to your guest?
No, we were too careful for that. He would have found out the fashion in which we had executed our commission.
Then he is still in expectation of the money?
Mon Dieu, yes. He wrote again yesterday, but his own servant this time took the letter to the post.
You say the attorney's wife is old and ugly?
50 years old at least, sir, and far from handsome, from what Patton says.
Be comforted, then. Her heart will melt towards him, and at any rate Porthos cannot owe you much.
What? Not much? It is 20 pistoles already, without reckoning the surgeon. Oh, he denies himself nothing. It is plain that he has always been accustomed to live well.
Well, even if the Duchess should fail him, he will find friends, I can assure you. So, my dear landlord, do not disturb yourself, and continue to be most attentive to his comfort.
You have promised me, sir, not to say a word about the attorney's wife or the wound.
That is agreed. You have my word.
Oh, he would kill me, do you see?
Do not be afraid. He is not half such a devil as he seems. Saying these words, D'Artagnan mounted the stairs, leaving the landlord a little more encouraged concerning 2 things, of which he appeared to think a good deal, his money and his life. At the top of the stairs, D'Artagnan found, on the most conspicuous door of the corridor, a gigantic number 1, marked with black ink. At this door he knocked, and, being invited from within, entered the room. Porthos was lying down and playing at lansquenet with Mousqueton, to keep his hand in whilst a spit burdened with partridges was turning before the fire, and at the 2 corners of an immense chimney there were boiling, on 2 chafing dishes, 2 saucepans from which exhaled the double odour of a fricassee of fowls and a hotch-potch of fish which delighted the olfactory nerves. Besides, the top of a desk and the marble slab of a commode were covered with empty bottles. At sight of his friend, Porthos uttered a loud and joyful cry, whilst Mousqueton, rising respectfully, gave up his place to him, and went to glance into the 2 saucepans, of which he appeared to have particular charge.
"Ah, egad, it is you!" said Porthos. "Welcome, welcome! Excuse me for not rising to meet you, but—" added he, looking with some anxiety at D'Artagnan. "You know what has happened to me?"
"No."
"Has the innkeeper told you nothing?"
"I asked for you and came up directly."
Porthos appeared to breathe more freely.
"And what has happened to you, then, my dear Porthos?" continued D'Artagnan.
"It happened that, in lunging at my adversary, to whom I had already given 3 sword wounds, and whom I wished to finish by a 4th, my foot caught against a stone, and I sprained my knee."
"Indeed.
"Yes, upon my honour. Lucky it was for the rascal, too, for I should otherwise have left him dead upon the spot, I assure you."
"And what became of him?"
"Oh, I know nothing about that. He had had quite enough of it, and went away without asking for the remainder. But you, my dear D'Artagnan, what happened to you?"
"So that," continued D'Artagnan, "it is this sprain that keeps you in bed, my dear Porthos?"
"Ah, mon Dieu, yes, that is all. But in a few days I shall be on my legs again."
"But why did you not get yourself removed to Paris? You must have been sadly dull here."
"It was my intention. But, my dear friend, I must confess one thing to you."
"And what is that?"
"It is that as I became cruelly dull, as you say, and as I had in my pocket the 75 pistoles with which you provided me, I invited up a passing traveller and proposed to him a game of dice. He agreed, and, faith, my 75 pistoles passed from my pocket to his, without reckoning my horse, which he carried off into the bargain. But you, my dear D'Artagnan,
what would you have, my dear Porthos? You cannot be favoured in all your pursuits," said D'Artagnan. "You know the proverb, lose at play and win at love. You are too fortunate in love for play not to revenge itself. But what do these changes of fortune signify to you? Happy dog! Have you not still got your duchess to assist you?"
"Nay, look, my dear D'Artagnan, how unlucky I am," replied Porthos, in the most unconcerned tone in the world. "I have written to her to send me some 50 louis, for which I have particular occasion in my present position."
"Well?"
"Well, she must be gone to her estate, for she has sent me no answer."
"Really?"
"No. So I sent a second letter yesterday, rather more urgent than the first. But, my dear fellow, let us chat about your own affairs. I confess I was beginning to feel some uneasiness on your account."
"But your host has behaved pretty well to you, apparently," said D'Artagnan, pointing to the teeming stewpans and the empty bottles.
"So-so," replied Porthos. "But it is only 2 or 3 days ago now since the impudent fellow brought me up his bill, and I showed them the door, both himself and his bill. So that I am now living here in something of the style of a conqueror. And, as you see, being somewhat afraid of being attacked in my redoubts, I am armed to the very teeth."
"Nevertheless," said D'Artagnan, laughing, "it seems that you sometimes make sorties." And he pointed to the stewpans and the bottles.
"It is not me, unfortunately," said Porthos. "This miserable sprain keeps me in my bed. But Mousqueton there forages the country for supplies." "Mousqueton, my friend," continued Porthos, "you see that a reinforcement has arrived. We shall want an addition to our rations."
"Mousqueton," said D'Artagnan, "there is a service you must do me."
"What is it, sir?"
"To give your recipe to Planchet. I may chance to be besieged myself hereafter, and I should not be at all sorry to enjoy all the advantages with which you gratify your master."
"Oh, sir," said Mousqueton modestly, "nothing is more easy. One must be a little adroit, that is all. I was brought up in the provinces, and my father, in his leisure moments, was something of a poacher."
"And how was he occupied in business hours?"
"He was engaged in a pursuit, sir, which I have always found a very happy one."
"What was that?"
"As it was in the time of the wars between the Catholics and the Huguenots, and as he saw Catholics exterminating Huguenots and Huguenots exterminating Catholics, all in the name of religion, he had made for himself a sort of mixed belief, which permitted him to be at one time a Catholic and at another a Huguenot. He had a habit of walking out behind the hedges on the roadside, with his carbine at his shoulder, and, when he saw a solitary Catholic coming, the Protestant religion immediately predominated in his mind. He lowered his carbine in the direction of the traveller, and then, when he was at 10 paces from him, opened a conversation which almost always ended by the traveller relinquishing his purse to redeem his life." Of course, when he saw a Huguenot coming, he was seized with such an ardent Catholic zeal that he could not comprehend how it had been possible for him, only a quarter of an hour before, to doubt the superiority of our most holy faith. For myself, sir, I am a Catholic. My father, having in conformity to his principles, made my elder brother a Huguenot. And what was the end of the worthy man? Asked D'Artagnan. Most unfortunate, sir. He found himself caught in a defile between a Catholic and a Huguenot, with whom he had done some business previously, and they both recognized him. So they united against him and hung him on a tree. And then they came and boasted of their foolish work in the very wine shop in the village where my brother and I were drinking. And what did you do? Asked D'Artagnan. We let them talk, replied Mousqueton. Then, as they went opposite roads when they left the wine shop, my brother posted himself in the path of the Catholic, and I lay in wait for the Protestant. It was all settled 2 hours after. We had done the business of both of them, admiring the forethought of our poor father, who had taken the precaution to educate us each in a different faith. In fact, as you say, Mousqueton, your father seems to have been a very intelligent fellow. And you tell me that the worthy man was, in his leisure moments, a poacher? Yes, sir. And it was he who taught me to set a snare and fix a night line. The consequence was that when I found our shabby landlord was feeding us on coarse meats, fit possibly for clowns, but not at all suitable to stomachs so delicate as ours, I had recourse again to my old trade. As I sauntered through the woods, I laid my snares in the paths. And, as I reclined beside the water, I slipped my lines into the ponds. In this way, thank God, we have experienced no scarcity, as you may be satisfied, sir, of partridges or rabbits, of carps or eels, and these are light and wholesome viands, highly suitable to sick persons. But wine, said D'Artagnan. Your landlord furnishes the wine? That is to say, answered Mousqueton, yes and no. What? Yes and no? He furnishes it, it is true, but he is unconscious of honor. Explain yourself, Mousqueton. Your conversation is deep. This is the way of it. It chanced that in my wanderings I met with a Spaniard who had seen many countries, and, amongst others, the New World. And what connection can there be between the New World and those bottles on the desk and drawers? Patience, sir. Everything will come in its turn. That is fair, Mousqueton. I trust to you and listen. This Spaniard had a servant, who had accompanied him on his voyage to Mexico. This servant was a compatriot of mine, and we became attached to one another the more quickly as our characters were much alike. We were both particularly fond of hunting, and he related to me how in the Pampas the natives hunt tigers and bulls simply with nooses of rope, which they throw over the necks of these terrible animals. At first I would not believe that they could attain so great a degree of address as to throw the end of a rope on which they wished at the distance of 20 or 30 paces. But with the proof before me, I was obliged to recognize the truth of his recital. My friend placed a bottle at 30 paces off, and at each throw caught it by the neck in a running noose. I practiced this exercise, and as nature has given me some capacity, I can now throw the lasso as well as any man in the world. Well, do you understand? Our landlord has a well-furnished cellar, of which he never loses sight of the key. But this cellar has an air hole, and through that air hole I throw the lasso. And, as I now know the best corner, I always draw from thence. This is the connection, sir, between the New World and the bottles on the desk and drawers. And now, will you taste our wine, and without prejudice you will tell us what you think of it? Thanks, my friend, thanks, but I have already breakfasted. Well, said Porthos, Make all ready, Mousqueton, and whilst we breakfast, D'Artagnan will tell us what has happened to him during the 10 days that he has been absent from us.
Whilst Porthos and Mousqueton breakfasted with all the appetite of convalescence, and that brotherly familiarity which draws men together in misfortune,